It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. Cranberries are a wild native fruit to Cape Cod. Native Americans introduced cranberries into Cape Cod. And early settlers were taught how to use the cranberries and even use them for medicinal purposes and to produce a red dye. In the North Village of Dennis, Henry Hall discovered cultivated cranberries by accident in 1816. An industry was born with many retired sea captains taking up the cranberry business, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And joining us are both Annie Walker, owner of Annie's Crannies, and Molly Walker, who's a next generation cranberry farmer. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Hello. Thanks for having us.
So let's start with describing and understanding the cranberry as a fruit. I don't know that, I think people sometimes think of it as that berries aren't fruits. They're maybe nuts or something else, and even nuts can be declared to be fruits as well. But why don't you describe kind of the life of a cranberry, if that makes any sense.
Well, it is a fruit. There are three native fruits to America, the cranberry, the blueberry, and the Concord grape. The life cycle of the cranberry starts, it's a double cyclical situation where it grows one crop over top of the next. So in the spring, you have the bud that was set last August starting to form, get bigger. It eventually will push out a flower, a pinhead. The flower will fall off and leave a tiny, tiny piece of fruit called a pinhead. And that tiny pinhead will grow the length of the stamen, and that will be your berry. That happens pretty much from June, July, the fruit sets. The July, the fruit grows. August, you have berries. Right now, it's a nice, cool, breezy day here at the bog. We like to see that because the berries will feel that. They'll start to shut down and turn red. So
they're queuing from nature cues, right?
Absolutely.
And it's not just sun, the lack of sunlight, but it's also they need the cold.
It's about degree days and sunlight days. So it takes 120 days out of the winter for it to start blowing its dormancy, to come out of its dormancy. It takes 120 heat-sensitive days.
Wow.
And then it's the reverse in the fall. So, we're looking forward right now to these cold nights. Last night here on the bog, it was 49 degrees on the bog. Quite chilly.
That's really chilly.
If it was 32, I would have had to get up in the middle of the night and turn the sprinklers on to protect from freeze.
Yeah, so to help our listeners, I'm looking out at what to you guys would be a bog, but to me doesn't look like a bog. You know, so I'm seeing an area that has some plants, and it's got a perimeter around it that looks like a ditch.
Correct.
And that ditch would have water in it, or can have water in it.
Correct.
But it looks kind of flat. It's a little bit lower than the ground. But then I see you have sprinklers set up out there, and that I was going to ask you what those are for, but they're obviously for if you get too cold.
Correct. What you're actually looking at, all that green, that field of green, is cranberry vine. It's about 6 or 8 inches tall. That's it. They don't grow in water. It's a misnomer. The ditches are actually there to drain the water away. They grow in sand. They like to be moist, but not too wet. But they like it to get dried out. If they're too wet, the roots will sit in the water and create a fungus. There'll be a fungus, and you have all sorts of problems with your fruit later on.
So they were native to the Cape, right?
Mm-hmm. The glaciers left them here.
Really?
Yep.
And they sort of are just came down with part of the glacier? Do we know?
We don't know. We just know they've been here for as long as Cape Cod has been here.
That's really wonderful. And I know this was, Dennis particularly was, as we kind of did in the promo a little bit, but Dennis was kind of the beginning of the cranberry industry, right?
Correct. It was the birthplace of the cultivated cranberry, purely by accident, when native yellow sand, not beach sand, but native yellow sand from a storm blew across the vine. And Henry Hall thought, there goes his berries. But instead, the next year, he grew twice as many. And that's because cranberries, like strawberries, have runners. And so if there's a lot of juice in the plant itself, it will set off a runner. That runner is now on the ground. The sand covers the runner, and it'll sprout up new uprights. And the berries are on the uprights.
Yeah, and so when I look at the bog, it does now make more sense if I compare it to something like a strawberries, except strawberries we tend to grow in the rows. Mm-hmm. With the between, although when you see wild strawberries, they grow more like this, mm-hmm. Kind of a vine, and they're low. And that now makes perfect sense to me. As I look across there, I can see that those are vines, and they've got berries all over, mm-hmm. right? And they like the sand, so they can send their runners. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting you mentioned beach sand versus the other. There was I listened to somebody else's podcast that had dealing with sand, but in terms of how it was used for glass. And it's interesting, there are different sands, and people forget that, not just mm-hmm. the rock compound, but quartz will be a more yellow kind of sand, mm-hmm. And it can glom together or hold together more, and whether they use it for glass making. But they can't use beach sand or desert sand because the wind has rolled it mm-hmm. and made it too smooth. It's like marbles, and it won't work. So the cranberries must like this more kind of rough sand.
Correct. There's all different grades. Like on Cape Cod, we have in-ground septic systems. It's called Title V systems, and they use the same grade of sand that we need on our bogs. So that made the price of sand go sky high when all of a sudden everybody was, you know, clamoring for the same kind of sand we need, the same size of the sand.
So we always see things where there is a cranberry grower, you know, like Ocean Spray, their ads, they're always standing in water. So that's the misnomer, right? I mean, really, cranberries don't like to be flooded.
The reason why they're standing in water is because the 96% of the industry was wet pick. And that's what people associate cranberries with. They like to see them floating. It's beautiful in the fall, the foliage, the red berries floating in the water. It's gorgeous. And that's what 96% of the industry was doing until this year.
Till this year?
This year.
What happened?
Everybody's wet picking because the middlemen have decided that they want this new, bigger fruit that they've come up with, and it all gets wet harvested. So instead of operating two plants where you have a wet harvest plant and a dry harvest plant, they just want them all delivered wet, and then they're going to take berries and put them under heat lamps and blow dryers, claim that they're fresh fruit, and put them in little plastic bags to come to
wow.
a grocery store near you.
So we'll talk about this a little bit more as to why they're doing it. But obviously, it's because of finance mm-hmm. and how much money they can make doing it. But that bothers me, and I would think it bothered our listeners a little bit to realize that they're kind of faking what really is dry cranberries.
Yeah, we have a cranberry marketing committee that's part of the USDA to represent the cranberry industry. But what really needs to happen is a vote needs to be taken that they label the bags as to what's happening. That's all I ask.
Yeah, like we do with anything else, right?
Just tell people that these were wet, dry. That's it. And people right. can make the choice themselves
as to whether they want. Yeah, we put organic on it or we don't. Right. Or these were harvested by, people sustainably farmed mm-hmm. or we do all those kinds of labels. You're right. That should be a simple thing.
Right. But those labels don't exist because, like I said, less than 4% of the industry was fresh fruit. As of last year, when we went to market, our independent middleman sold his company to a Canadian company. And we were told up at market that there was probably around 10 of us left in the state of Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness.
But of that, only 4 actually delivered to market.
Yeah.
Ocean Spray, on their behalf, Ocean Spray does have some fresh, dry-picked growers still happening.
And they're still, I would assume they'd want to market it that way, too.
I would think so, too. Maybe this will get their attention.
Maybe it will. Molly, one of the questions I have, so you know now that the conditions of what's changing and how the industry is, and so you're like wanting to be a future cranberry farmer. What in the world are you going to be looking at and thinking about what you're going to do to have that future?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one for sure, because we can't even predict what this season's going to be like the next couple months, so it's hard to think about the years after that when this year could really prove to be the end if the numbers don't add up. It's hard to think about investing tens of thousands of dollars into something where you're already in the red. So what would be the incentive there? I don't know. Besides keeping this beautiful tradition going, but
well, there is something magical about it. I mean, Annie, you walked me into the barn, which was really magical to see the kind of equipment and to have that feel of what it was really like. Have you had thoughts, Molly, of thinking that maybe there's some kind of a living history part to this, or an exhibit part?
Definitely.
That would keep it alive as for a different reason.
Right, something of a museum, and Annie here has done a great job of collecting all sorts of antique equipment that's historical to this very place, so that is special to be able to share with people. And right now Annie's so busy that she can really only focus on the fall and running a little fall shop, but it would be great to be able to share this with all the summer tourists if we had some sort of museum, and that could go hand in hand with more people and getting more money that way to make this whole thing float.
I like the word. I think the great thing that we could, you know, that you might be able to think about in the future would be partnering with somebody else out here who has like camps. I could see there being a cranberry day. I mean, a cranberry camp day for different various camps that are out here, and also for families to come out and have a cranberry day. And I know, Annie, you showed me in the barn, too, that, you know, you have a family reunion and you have the stuff to set up. But I could see big harvest tables out here and things like that. So I think there is maybe as you look forward, there might be some grant opportunities where somebody would say that's important for us to keep that.
Tried a time or two, but can always try again. And then there is also the beehives and everything. I think that would be great to get the public more involved with the plight of the honeybees.
So I see beehives. Are the beehives here for beyond just having the beehive? Do they help with the cranberry bog?
Sure do. If the bees don't kiss the flowers, we don't have any fruit. They all need to be pollinated. Everything, trees need to be pollinated. Grass needs to be pollinated. Everything needs to be kissed by those little lovely bees. So yes.
Yeah, and they're going for, you know, that it's wonderful how fruit works, right? The flower. So the flower puts out a nectar that they really want. Mm-hmm. But accidentally, as they go in there because they have free little legs, they get the pollen. And then the pollen gets moved from flower to flower, which people think they harvest the pollen. They don't. That goes into actually the pollination. But they really like that really sweet kind of nectar that they're trying to get out of.
You've done your homework.
I've done a couple things on with bees and some of the issues that we have where we also they're in trouble as well and. It's like all things that are in nature are compounding. Mm-hmm. The last I had read, there were at least maybe 6 or 7 different possible reasons that probably all are contributory. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those things we talk about, cascade effects, where it's like anybody who played the little game with the straws that went into the camel, you know, that plastic game that they had as kids. Mm-hmm. You put the one in, one breaks the camel's back. We think with the beehive collapse, it may be a matter. It's not just one thing, but there's a lot of factors that could go in.
I believe that that's true. And one part of those factors you were talking about is everything is the same now, especially on Cape Cod. Everybody has the perfect lawns with the perfect trees and the perfect, and that's not how nature operates. It's perfect in its imperfectness. And so if you don't have dandelions for the butterflies and the bees to kiss, they're missing that particular vitamin that's in that plant. If they're just going after cranberries, that's not healthy either. You have to provide different sources. And year-round, different sources of things for them to get on.
Yeah, it really makes me cry to think about, as I see not here but across the country, I see more and more people putting in turf grass because that's what they understand, which is not a sustainable thing anyway because it takes huge amounts of resources to make it grow because it doesn't want to grow here. And what we do to make it successful, it kills everything else off, including the healthy soil. And so we get into this really terrible cycle. And the other is on the Cape particularly is water usage. And so, you know, people don't realize we only have so much water. It's what's in the aquifer here of fresh water. And if that got depleted by watering turf grass lawns, that's a really sad thing because that runoff tends to go back into the ocean, gets salinated, and so we're not seeing it back in our groundwater in the same way. So that's you've got all that. So where did originally the cranberry was here? We know that indigenous peoples actually used them. What were some of the uses early on, both indigenous but also in early settlers?
Well, you mentioned dye, and the natives used it for dye for their outfits, etc. They used it for they would make a pumice out of it and store their venison meat in it, because everybody pretty much knows that urinary tract cranberries is great, and the reason why it's great is because it has properties that actually have bacteria attached to it, and it flushes out your system. So that's why cranberries are great. It's bad cells, bad bacteria attach to the cranberry and flush out through your system. So that's the same as true of them storing their meat in the ground. It would keep the bacteria out of their meats. So that was a huge way for them to make their venison meat last longer.
Yeah, and, on dyes, when we think about that, so I know what the cranberry looks like. Is the dye that color? Because often... You probably know this, but often dyes from something don't look like what the actual juice is of the plant.
No. Mark, come spend a day here cleaning berries with us, and your white T-shirt will be tie-dyed red.
Tie-dyed red. And my hands.
And your hands.
That's great. So one of the things that you were beginning to talk about in there, and that is the difference really between a dry... harvested. So it's really, you were mentioning for those ads that it's wet harvested is what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Why dry harvested versus wet? What's the difference?
Well, when you dry harvest your berries, they're dry. And a berry, once it's picked off the vine and it gets wet, the water is absorbed into the berry. So therefore, it starts to rot from the inside out. It has no keeping quality. So that's a big problem if you're somebody who likes to bake. You cut open this other version of berries, and you're going to find that they're rotten. That was a big complaint we had last fall with a lot of our customers showed up after they had bought berries from local stores, only to realize when they cut them open, they were actually rotten on the inside. And that's a problem. So hopefully they'll figure that out at market. And hopefully they'll start labeling their bags that tell people that they're wet dry as opposed to dry fresh.
So I get then my understanding would be that the reason that they flooded them was it would float the berries up.
The berries are hollow on the inside. There's four air chambers.
Oh.
So because there's four air chambers, that's why the berries float.
And then I could surface harvest those, kind of mass harvest them.
They corral them. You take a big boom.
Oh, that's fun.
And you corral them into a big circle. Okay. That's what everybody sees the pictures of. And then they go up either an elevator into the back of a truck, or really what they want nowadays is these berry pumps. So the pump will actually suck the berries up, water, berries, leaves, sticks, everything. And then there's a division bucket up at the top. Right now, all the creamery growers who hear this are laughing. But there's a big container up at the top, and the leaves and trash go one direction, and the clean berries go into the truck. When the truck gets full, that drives to market, and generally within 24 hours, that becomes a juice concentrate.
How long, how long will a cranberry stay if it isn't, like, canned or something else happening to it?
A fresh, dry cranberry. We tell people berries will last a month. I've had people tell us our berries last how long, Molly?
Until Christmas sometimes.
So a couple months anyway. I've had people say that at Easter they went to their garage and they still had berries. So, but I grow house, which there's a whole bunch of varieties, first of all, just like oranges and apples. There's 168 varieties of traditional berries, and then there's 8 new Rutgers University cross-pollinated varieties, which are huge. They're almost the size of a golf ball, just slightly. I mean, those are what they make the craisins out of, because when they dry up, they're still a viable size. If you take an early black or a house and try to dehydrate them, there's not much left to them. So I forgot what I was saying.
Oh, no, that's fine. About how long they last, we were talking about the season for them.
Oh, so the different varieties. Yeah, so house and early blacks are, we say a month. The early black variety, and they're the traditionally dry-picked berries, too, they are ripe, early blacks, from mid-September through mid-October, and house are from mid-October through Thanksgiving.
That's really interesting. So that brings to mind why the traditions, right? We're around the holidays. Mm-hmm. It's just the harvest season. Mm-hmm. And so you see them really, really being fresh around Thanksgiving time. It makes perfect sense. You could make all kinds of things out of them, and they did. And then they would still be around for the Christmas holidays and that kind of time. And then it starts like any other fruit. But we get so confused today, don't we? Because of the way we can, from all over the world in different places, we can have it be in season, right? So berries, I can get blackberries even though they're not in season.
No. Eat your fruit in season. That means you're buying local and you're buying fresh. Right. When you start getting blueberries in January, it's coming from Chile.
Right. Or I start getting apples somewhere. Or I get apples that have been tried to be stored, but they're not the same. They're not crunchy anymore. They get mealy. As we get into now, we're starting to see fresh apples again. Mm-hmm. But people don't realize, because there is something there. So I think even probably my grandchildren are looking at and saying, they grow all year round. They do somewhere in the world.
Well, that's one really good thing about tradition of dry harvested cranberries. There's a short 6-week span, and that's it. And you're not going to get them when they run out. I also sell to Whole Foods. They always say, do you have more berries for the Christmas market? It's a limited market in order to keep them fresh.
So, Molly, when you're thinking about the cranberries and thinking about what drew you to want to do this along with the family tradition of having done this?
I don't know. This property has always been pretty magical to me, even when she bought it and restored it back in the 90s, just as a kid being able to play on some wild land, and then hearing about how my great-grandfather used to do the same. Then I went off to college at UVM and got really enamored with the whole local food movement, and kind of hand-in-hand with climate change and just seeing food as kind of a solution. And my summer's off coming back and working with my aunt and the bees, and love being outside. And I think a sense of place is really important. And so it all kind of comes together with farming. Yeah.
What was your degree in?
Community and international development and applied economics, which they've now turned into a local food systems major, but that wasn't available when I was there. And then anthropology, so kind of studying back to man and their connection to this earth and how we got where we got now.
So it makes kind of perfect sense, because those weave together to me to what is really important for us, which is looking at sustainability, right? And so economics is part of sustainability, as well as the other parts that you're looking at, plus our history as humans.
Yes.
how do we get to where we are? We're not all bad. yes. But we've had moments, right, mm-hmm. where we have had to learn that we can't, what we're doing wasn't sustainable, and sometimes at our own loss.
Right.
And to the environment. Now we're at those critical moments. Mm-hmm. You are here on the bog because of practices that try to force things to not be the natural way that they would be doing it.
Right. Just so now that they're going to truck the local berries up to Canada and flash dry them and ship them back down here that's just a lot of oil and a lot of waste when we could be just keeping the berries local and selling them straight to the consumers down the road. It's the way of commodification, I guess, but it'd be nice to be able to keep it local somehow, some way.
I think, you know, that's really important. Anyway,
I was just going to jump on Molly. It is very frustrating. One of the reasons why I did this, restored this land and did all this, is because it was a family tradition and I wanted the next generation to partake and get to feel what we felt growing up on the Cape that doesn't exist much anymore. But also, as Molly had said to me before, when you have a small farm and you invite people to your farm, it's a sense of community. It's your give back to community. And that's really what we all need to be doing. We all need to slow down and not only give back to community like ourselves and each other and all of that, the process, but Mother Nature. We need to look at the trees and it drives me crazy when people are building houses and they clear cut every single tree off the property. It's not needed. It's not needed. You can build around the trees. I did, but that whole sense of community, both environmental and human contact community, is really what small farms in America are all about.
Yeah, and we forget. I mean, every it's so funny. Every child grows up with those little farm sets, right? Still today, which is the traditional farm, which isn't what the farm is. But all that is what a small local farm, when I look around your property, you've got small outbuildings, barns, you've got equipment. It feels that way. However, what we forget is where most of our produce comes from, is what you were saying, Molly. It moves across. It uses incredible amounts of fuel. And then people don't realize that even the fertilizers we use are extracted from oil sources. And so we get into a really compounding situation that makes it really tough.
And Annie here, this bog is not like probably any other bog that's in operation. They're all, whoever's in the game now is just, it's way larger scales. They're using helicopters to spray. It's all computerized. Nobody's waking up to check the temperature and get the sprinklers out to protect their crop. It's all alerts and this place is pretty unique.
Molly, I'm antiquated.
No, it's special, and I'd like to share it with people before they even know it was a thing, before it disappears.
It is special, and it's special in a variety of ways, because we are really coming, and that's the science part of all this. We really are coming to that point where, the Green Revolution and what we did in agriculture can feed more people. However, what we've created also at that cost is a lot of monocrops, a lot of practices that we can't sustain because of those costs will forever go up. So what I would see is what you guys are talking about is there are people that are the middle people that are choosing to do it in big agriculture, and they're choosing to do it in a way that's short-term gain, but there's no way that is long-term sustainable. Something gives and is already beginning to give in all that. And the more chemicals we spray, the more things we use, that's really, really tough on the environment, and not only in the manufacture of those chemicals, but also in the what happens to the legacy afterwards. So you would be worried out here about what everybody is worried about in agriculture that is at a small scale, and that is you're dependent on two really big things. One is water, which is in crisis everywhere. and the other is global climate change, which is the weather is it becomes more unpredictable. It was already unpredictable, but as it becomes even extremely more unpredictable, that's got to be something that's also worrisome.
It's been huge. We a few years ago, out of the blue, we had hail for the first time. Now we've had hail, been hit by hail twice on our berries. We had drought situations where you wouldn't know by looking at the bog now because it looks all green. But last year we had probably a quarter of this property was dead because we couldn't keep up. We were out there with 5-gallon buckets of water trying to dump it on the vine. And we couldn't cool the vine down. We couldn't keep it up. It meant nothing, the work we were doing. But it helped save the deep roots. And so this spring, the vine came back. We hand-sanded and hand-watered. Climate has changed a lot. I have a bug right now that I've never had before. The girls from the Cranberry Experiment Station up in Carver, Wareham, Onset, that area, off Cape, over the bridge. They came down the other day because I said, I've got a bug I've never seen before, and it's called a flea beetle, and it's chewed up all my, in spots on the far bog, if you'll see the, wherever there was lush growth, they chewed all this year's buds. They're going after my berries, and chewed all the vine. Why did that happen? Because we had a severe winter hit in May. May 18th, I think the date was. And yes, I went out and turned on my sprinklers to try to warm it up, but it happened so fast and so much that the high spots got nipped. So now if my vine gets nipped because it froze, now there's no bud left to hold it back, the growth back, which would normally go into the berry. So instead it went into the vine. So then I had all these lush spots of vine, and now with climate change, I've got new bugs that we've never seen before come and attack my bog.
Right, because they've moved up as the warmth has moved up. And you've created a perfect condition for them because now you have this lush vegetation that they like.
But it's that's cyclical according to Mother Nature. I mean, she took it away, then she created this growth.
This is normal.
Even though I didn't put out any fertilizer.
I know when we think about, you know, I think about nuts and berries, and when we think about them in other forms other than cranberries, that they tend to have also a cyclical nature of high harvest to low harvest. Does that happen to you too?
Sure. Early blacks in particular, they have a good year and a bad year, a good year and a bad year. You can rely on that like clockwork. I'm fortunate that my hows are pretty consistent. It's more weather dependent if I'm going to lose some of the crop. But it's a little more consistent. I'm also lucky in a way that it is such a small area, small bog, that I can micromanage things. So
right.
I don't have to put out herbicides. I hand weed. I don't have to do things that big growers have to do.
Right. And, you know, as I'm looking out here, it is small.
Mm-hmm. It's just 3 acres of bog.
But there's just something that it is magical, I've got to say.
She also has then the highest yield crop per acre for the whole country, probably.
So that tells you something about your practices, right?
Well, it's like I said, I don't fly my fertilizer on. If I do go out and fertilize, I hand crank. So while I'm hand cranking, I can see a spot doesn't need it. I shut my little tank off and keep walking right over top of it and turn it back on. So you can micromanage what you have. And I'm a beekeeper, so I have all these hives 20 feet from the bog, so that helps. And we have a lot on Cape Cod. We're really fortunate. We have 8 species of native bees that live in the ground, little tiny bees that look like mosquitoes, all the way up to bumblebees, a few different varieties of bumblebees. So bees, they're the gift for sure.
That's really great.
But also this year you lost all your bees, right, to start the season?
I did. I had a big, for the first time ever since 1996 when colony collapse disorder happened. I reported it to the state, and I was one of the first ones to report saying something just happened to all my bees. This year it's different. I pretty much know what happened to my bees. We had a really bad cold snap in February.
Right. Unusual.
And that's when they break apart to get to their stores, because I leave honey on for them. I make sure, I only take half their honey, so I make sure they have food. So when they break apart and all of a sudden the cold gets in, they can't get back together. So the queen now isn't protected for heat. They go around her to leave her in the right. center. So when it separates like that, so several hives went because of that. Yeah, I had some just neglect on my part. I didn't close my front entrances enough, and some mice moved in. So I could pretty much tell what it was. But, yeah, that February blast pretty killed us. I wrap my bees, too. Molly helps. Molly helps a lot in the bee yard. And we wrap the hives every winter to try to keep some of the wind out. I mean, we're right. You can feel the wind today. We are right down. The beach is right there. Those houses
right.
behind me are on the bluff.
Right. The bay, the Cape Cod Bay is right over, not far from here. And, yeah, you get a cool breeze all the time. And the water, even today, is only 64, which is chilly. As water goes. So, yeah, you're going to always have that and in the winter. At the same time, it also protects you in some ways as well because it doesn't, doesn't cool down as fast as you would with a river or stream or other things. I've been talking with my guests, Annie and Molly Walker, about the history of the current state of cranberry farming. Join me for more conversation after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise, and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with my guests, Annie and Molly Walker, about the history and craft of bringing cranberries to the table. Annie, you just went out and you grabbed certain parts of the vine, and if I can describe it for people, what you've got is a very long, what you call the runner, and it looks to me like a little stem, and it's got little tiny, what I call leaves on them. The leaves are really hard to describe, except that they look like little, would you say they look like little paddle or end of an oar or a paddle? They're really small. And at one end are the roots. And then this thing runs across. And then you were saying, then you've also brought the shoots that go up. What do you call those?
Those are called the uprights.
Uprights. And then on the very tip of that, and I think that's really interesting, is this little, almost, you wouldn't have noticed it if you hadn't pointed it out, but this little tiny, what would be the bud, right?
Correct.
For something.
That's
and
next
you
year's
said
crop.
It's next year's crop.
Yep, that's next year's crop.
So is this lot like berries, like blackberries and those, where the canes of this year that had a crop are not the ones for next year?
No, this year, the way it works here is every upright can have fruit every year.
Every year.
Every year.
So unlike some of the other vines that we're used to where the old cane doesn't produce anymore.
Correct.
So this is really interesting.
So you have to take care of your vine. Right now we're taking care of the vine because there's berries out there, so you got to watch for that. You don't want them too hot. You have to turn the sprinkles on to cool them down, or else it's like making cranberry sauce on the vine. You also have to protect them from a freeze if it's 32 degrees now. And then as the berry season goes on and we get colder and colder nights, the more red in it, the better tolerance it has. So it can go down to 15, 16, 18 degrees, depending on the variety, before you have to turn your water on. But early in the season, like now, it would be 32 degrees. You also have to worry about the bud to make sure that the bud is taken care of. And that affects you when you're a fresh fruit grower, when you're a dry harvest grower, because you have to get the berries off the bog. You got to walk out there. But next year's crop is already out there. So you have to walk. We do training session where everybody learns to walk the correct direction, because if you walk in the correct direction, which is clockwise for a fresh fruit bog, then you'll be walking in the direction of the leaves. And as you step on the leaves actually flatten out and they go right over top of that bud at the very tip and protect it. But if you pick up a bag of berries, which is about 40 pounds, and you turn to put it on the wagon and the wagon is behind you, now you're walking backwards, the leaves go backwards, and you just smoked next year's crop. So in the summer, the bogs are in pink bloom from June to mid-July. We always invite our picking crew back to come see how pretty it is when it's all in blossom. And they know they don't want to come back because you can literally see the footprints of when somebody walked backwards because there's no flowers.
So I noticed something when and you were mentioning it just now, but I noticed something when I came in, and there's a big giant pile of sand.
Yes.
So what's the role? Do you have to add sand, or do you put sand?
I'm an IPM grower, which means integrated pest management, which means you work with Mother Nature as opposed to against.
Right.
You allow a certain percentage of your crop to go to bugs because the bugs feed the birds. You know,
right.
It's that kind
sure.
of thing. So, but an IPM method of growing is to put that sand on the bog to cover those runners so that the leaves will fall off the runners and shoot new uprights, and that's how you can increase your crop. It's also better drainage.
So you spread the sand over that.
Mm-hmm. So you can either do it by boat, where you put it on a boat and it paddles and drops it into the water, or you can dry sand, which is when you drive a sanding buggy. It looks like an old beach buggy when we were all kids on the beach, right?
Oh, that's funny.
So, and you drive in the direction of the vine so you don't do any damage, and you lay it on the vine. Or you do what we like to do when we can, is called ice sanding. But due to climate control, we haven't had been able to make enough ice for the past several years to get it on that way. And all you do is you drive on the ice. You get about 8-10 inches of ice. You drive this one-ton buggy out there, and it's got a little gate valve thing. You drop that, and it opens the back end, and it's like putting icing on a cake. And it just glides across the ice, about a half inch of sand every couple of years. The ice melts, the sand falls down between the uprights, and now you've smothered over bugs that try to winter over, so you don't have to put out a spray.
Then do you have to remove the sand?
No, they grow through it. They grow in sand, Mark. That's what we said early on in the program.
Why does it not just then keep getting built up?
It does. Hence the problem my husband is going to have with wet picking this season. His bog is 30 years old, and over the years it has built up so much, and then we take our compost and we topsoil it over our dikes, our roads, to build our roads up. But he hasn't kept up with the roads going up as much as the sand going up on the bog. So now his bogs are too high to wet.
Oh, so this is interesting. So this kind of berm that's around the edge of this, right?
Yep.
The dike that's
the dikes,
kind of around. That has, you have to keep going up with it too, right?
Right, because otherwise you're building the sand.
Otherwise,
up and
the
your
sand
bog
is going to get your bog's going to get above the water line.
After 30 years, you've increased.
I had no idea, and so I knew that people have described. You know, historically there were before we could get commercial sand, but there were borrow pits, pits that people actually got the sand from, and they were borrowing it sort of. But putting it in one place to do that. And I would assume that early on that was what was done.
That's one of the reasons. My grandfather, so that was one of the reasons why this bog skipped a generation. It actually left the family, and I bought it back into the family. Because my dad and my Uncle Danny would say that Grandpa would have them come out and help sand. Well, their version of sanding was not driving these buggies. It was driving a Model A across the ice, and they were hand shoveling it off the back of Model A. So that couldn't have been fun for the kids in the family to have to do that while Pa was driving across the ice.
That's really fun. So there's several things that you talked about that I want to go back on. One is, what does the honey taste like from cranberries?
Good.
Does it have a different taste than other honey? I know people make a big deal about what the taste of honey is depending on the pollination.
Well, bees will fly for 3 miles to get their resources. So unless you have a hive in the middle of a 3-mile radius bog, it's always mixed. So when people say that it's blueberry honey or it's this honey, very often that's just been infused. We don't do that. But what we do here is when we harvest the honey, we harvest one honey super at a time. We drain the equipment, and then we go for the next honey super. That way the honey isn't mixed, because we figure what the bees, they know what they're doing. We don't want to even mix their flavors. So sometimes out of a honey super, you might only get 15 pounds, and another time you might get 40 to 60 pounds out of deeps. So we don't do flavored tasting, is that right? We don't do samples, because of that. We'd have to have hundreds and hundreds, you wouldn't know. But we do, it does come out different colors. So generally, I do a harvest before the bog is in bloom, so before June 15th, and then I do one after the bog is out of bloom, so after July 15th. So the before June 15th is going to be a light colored honey. So very often that is mint, wild mint, or roses, the white native rambling roses you see go up trees, or it's a light colored honey, very sweet. And the cranberry honey is darker in color, and its flavor is a little more robust and not quite as sweet. That's what I think, anyway.
Okay, so it's probably following somewhat the life cycle of what's happening in the plants.
Yeah.
So, well, as I look out on the bog, what I see right now, not very many red things, but some oranges and yellow and that kind of color. And you're right, you're talking about that changing as it gets colder and that. So the process, do you know what's going into making it be red?
It's the cold, but what develops from it is something called TASI. That's the natural sugars in the fruit.
Okay, so
the higher your TASI number, the color of your skin on your fruit, the more sugar content it's going to have in it. People who make jelly know that about beech plums too, and that kind of thing. You're looking for that TASI.
So the redder that is, the more red we get. That yeah. Color is causing us to be sweeter.
Yes.
Yeah. Are cranberries somewhat bitter then in the stage that they are now, or are they
tot.
Sweet?
They're tot.
Tot.
They're good for your kissing muscles. They make you puck up.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's just so interesting about how things ripen and the sugar.
A cranberry will start green, and then it goes sort of white, and then it goes pink, and then it goes red. So if you have we call it a blush, if you have a cranberry that's pink, that's three quarters pink or pinkish reddish, that is going to turn red. It's just like a banana, you know, ripens off the vine.
Right.
So do cranberries. They'll ripen off the vine. Wow. So those are still good berries. But one of the things that happens in Wisconsin is it has such a short growing season that a lot of the berries remain white. So that's why they came up with white cranberry juice. But now you know the sugar is in the red. So the first ingredient in that white cranberry juice is sugar, unfortunately.
Right, just to make, to be able to have that.
To
offset the lack of that. Yeah, and that's a balancing act. That's even in, you know, grapes when we talk about wine. It's always a balancing act as to where, at what stage, right, you harvest that, because you've got more sugar depending on which one. Mm-hmm. Molly, when I think about what you're going to be then challenged with and what's coming, why would you want to hold on to this and to take this on yourself? What is it that's so important about this life and what I see out here, besides the obvious that I get to experience that our listeners don't, which is sitting here and seeing something really spectacular? What is it?
Well, I think it's kind of, once it's gone, it's gone. And the thought of that is pretty sad. So why to hold on to it? You just can't replicate it. It's very unique. It's kind of just...
preservation of that, just in itself. That's how I felt, too. Yeah. The preservation of holding on to a piece of something that wouldn't exist. The preservation of holding on to something that wouldn't exist unless I did it.
Right, and it's not only you and I and our family, but just of this area and the history and the land. It's bigger than us, and it feels...
I think you're getting to where I was hoping that I could lead you a little bit, and that was that there is something about farming and growing and living on the land that far and exceeds the commercialization. And our society has really not, some people are beginning to embrace that, but it, the idea of making money, that seemed to be the end all, but this is not a really great money-making proposition for you.
Small farms and across America don't make money. I don't know many farmers that do. They're not in it to make money. They're in it to work with Mother Nature. They're in it to create something that helps feed their neighbors. They're not in it for the dollar bill. They're in it for the life experience and how to give back and be part of that cycle.
Yeah, and bringing to to us a high-quality product, a higher-quality kind of product as well to the local. Molly, you were going to say something?
I was just thinking about even the wildlife around here and just how built up this area's gotten, even just around her bog. You can see so many houses now. It used to be all wilderness and just it's a haven for a lot of the wildlife here. Annie typically names the foxes and keeps track of the babies and always seeing the footprints of coyotes. And
we have deer on the bog right over there. You see that scuffed vine over there? That's a baby. We think he's probably going to be a buck. He still has his spots on him, but he likes to jump around and go crazy out there.
It's just, it really is spectacular. And why, some of the reasons, particularly here, are its location. As I always know, most people who ever drive to the coastal region, as the more you get towards the ocean, you know, the trees get shorter and you have the views of the sky. You just know it's over the ridge, and we can see that here. And I can see watching all of that change. And while you have these frustrations and you have the things that are unknowns, at the same time, there's something that it must keep your spirit alive to be in harmony with that.
Well, like Molly said, for me, it is several layers, but one is definitely the wildlife, providing a place for them and them providing entertainment for me. Another and huge why I did this, like I said earlier, is my family, to share it with my family. One of my favorite moments is our family reunion that happens here every Labor Day. And all the cousins for generations get together and we have a big thing. And it's fun to share land knowing that my grandfather, who I actually never met, my Ben Walker, that this was all his and that we're still on family land, which is a rarity on Cape Cod these days. I'm a 12th generation Cape Codder. Molly's a 13th, and we have a 14th behind Molly, too.
That's really wonderful.
That is.
What a great thing. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others around your dinner table, hopefully having any of the ideas that we brought up today and thinking about the future of farmers as we think about small farmers and the life that they have and the importance that they have to us. And we'll be right back.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with my guests, Annie and Molly Walker. And Annie, there are two things before I get to kind of talking about. I am so curious because in your bio, it talks about you having been on Broadway. So I want to know more.
Sure. I started working theater backstage at the ripe old age of 16. I was a wardrobe supervisor for the Cape Playhouse, and I met Ginger Rogers. That was my first introduction. From there, I went on to Broadway. I worked Broadway for over 30 years. I also was a production wardrobe supervisor, and I worked on movies. And that's when we closed Crazy for You at the Schubert Theater on Broadway. The closing party, they went on to say how many weddings, births, deaths, divorces, everything happened during our five-year span on Broadway. And, of course, there was one bog, the purchase of one bog. And that, of course, was me. It was the joke in the beginning was that it was the bog that Broadway built. That simple. Broadway paid for this bog for me to come home and do this, so I'm ever thankful for all of that and all my friends that helped encourage it to happen.
That's an amazing story, and I love that connection between that. that the arts actually enabled you to have this.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, and then whenever all the actors come through the Cape Playhouse, which is right down the street from me, they would come visit the bog that they, you know, heard about and watch me bring pitches about on my desk and everything. Yeah.
Right. So when I think about the ways that our listeners can help, one of the obvious ways is what you started to say, you know, earlier on in the segment, and that was about this idea of what it means to be getting something local and knowing where your food comes from.
Absolutely. One of the key things you can do for cranberries this season, when you're buying your cranberries for your Thanksgiving table, whatnot, make sure the bag says where it's from. It's a product of Massachusetts, Wisconsin, whatever. And the second thing is to ask how they were harvested. With these dry harvested, if you're purchasing dry harvested berries, you're helping the small farms in America. There's only a few of us left, handful really, of us left doing this, and it supports the small cranberry growers, the traditional cranberry growers.
Right, and it's also about learning how to educate yourself about how to do those things, right? Mm-hmm. So how to read labels, mm-hmm. or how to ask.
And I'll tell you, it makes a difference. We do tours here during our weekends. We're open on Saturdays and Sundays from Columbus Day to the first weekend in November. And hopefully, if we have enough crew, then I give tours. And one thing I said to the tour people last year is ask, you know, are these cranberries dry harvested? And the next time I went to deliver my berries to Whole Foods, the manager comes running out, the produce manager, what does this mean, dry picked? Everybody's asking about dry picked berries. So a small grassroots movement can make a change. Because when they all start finding that everybody wants that, then that's what they'll start buying.
That's so great. Molly, anything you want to tell us before we finish up?
Hope to see you at Annie's Crannies starting Columbus Day. Okay. Come on down.
I'm so excited about that. I want to thank both my guests, Annie and Molly Walker. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.